Bo Young, who is part American Indian and the publisher of The White Crane, a journal for gay men, said the following in 2004 at the Utah Gay Men's Health Summit. While the form and function of same-sex roles have been diverse and wide-ranging over the centuries, if I step back for a second and in the true nature of a two-spirit person in the Native American tradition, look at the patterns and the connections rather than the differences and the separations, then very clear, inescapable models start to emerge. And when I look around at gay men and lesbians we know, I see us still carrying on the traditions, evolving as we go, and changing in how we relate to one another, perhaps, but not to culture and society. I see the artists, teachers, and priests, doctors, nurses, caretakers, counselors, and therapists, clowns, jesters, contraries, and cross-dressers. I see the good sons and daughters even in the face of revilement and rejection. While who I am as a modern gay man is in significant ways different from Native American Indian two-spirit people, the lessons of same-sex love and connection are clearly there to nurture us today. We are the people who are between the worlds, betwixt, and it has been in the loss, the denial to us and by us of this understanding that we are left a little bit lost, bothered, and bewildered. The activist Harry May started telling us all since 1950 that we are a separate people, gifted in ways that are unique to us as homosexual people. The Aboriginal peoples of North America, who Harry studied with extensively, as well as virtually all of the other pagan cultures of the world, have always known the simple fact: we are not simply what we do in bed. Harry Hay insisted even more simply and scientifically, citing none other than Darwin, that nothing prevails in nature. Nothing survives in nature that doesn't serve nature. It's not simply that only the strong survive. It's the useful that survive. And therefore, there must be some purpose that same-sex feeling survives. There must be some purpose, or homosexuality would not continue to exist across time and across species. There are clues all around us and in our history to guide us. All I need to do is open my eyes and my mind to receive the wisdom. I'll know it when I see it. The only signposts are my guts and my mind and my heart and my soul. And when I come across a truth, they resonate like a tuning fork, sounding together as one, because in fact we are one. It is good to know your role, and even better to know how to play it. It is good to be betwixt. It is a place of unique insight and outlook, perspective and wisdom. And it is that unique perspective that has always made people like us valuable to cultures that recognize our abilities. We ignore it at our peril. Society ignores it at our own peril. Close quote.
This is indeed true of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons. There are numerous clues in our history and the stories of our people. On May 27th of this year, the Salt Lake chapter of Affirmation hosted a 30th anniversary celebration at the Holiday United Church of Christ in honor of the founding of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons in Salt Lake City 30 years ago on June 11th, 1977. We celebrated that event through music and the sharing of stories and comments from participants and noted leaders. In honor of this milestone event, we asked people to write or record their experiences, to think back and share praise for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and intersexed people, our queer pioneers who came before and helped ease our own journey. We stepped up to the plate and enlightened the way for those who are following. As with all anniversaries, there is a regaling of history, and during the first few minutes of today, we'll share just that. After the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969 that sparked the gay rights era, many organizations were formed, and the political cloud of gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgendered communities started to be felt across the United States. To this growing visibility and political clout, fearful voices began to speak out. As a result of Anita Bryant's campaign against gays and lesbians, the anti-discrimination ordinance was repealed and legislation was passed, outlawing adoption by gays and lesbians in the state of Florida, and it spread across the U.S. As a mother, she declared, "I know that homosexuals cannot biologically produce children, therefore they must recruit our children." There were also Mormon voices that were caught up in this fear. Boyd K. Packard with his speeches to the One and for Young Men Only, among others. Ernest Wilkinson, president of BYU, and his witch hunts and telling BYU students to leave the campus for good. Spencer W. Kimball, homosexuality is an ugly sin, repugnant to those who find no temptation in it, as well as to many past offenders who are seeking a way out of its clutches. It is embarrassing and unpleasant as a subject for discussion, but because of its prevalence, the need to warn the uninitiated and the desire to help those who may already be involved in it. Gay and lesbian Mormons in the 1970s turned to the publishing world to help bring a voice of liberation to the stifling oppression of homophobia in Christian churches and society in general. Millionaire David Goodstein purchased the small Los Angeles Advocate gay newsletter. A year later, he moved it to San Francisco, called it simply The Advocate, and he hired gay return missionary and son of a Mormon bishop, Robert Isaac McQueen, as editor-in-chief. McQueen had worked at the University of Utah and as a journalist for the Salt Lake Tribune previously. Robert had known gay Mormons Tommy Harris and Ray Larson from his days in Salt Lake and hired them as associate editor and art director, respectively. Collectively, they referred to themselves as the Mormon Mafia. Much of the next few minutes of history are excerpts from the 27th celebration presentation by Connell O'Donovan. Or pull that one out.
Connell states, "The spring and summer of 1977 was an incredible crucible for the queer community, both locally and nationally. Dade County, Florida had become a rallying cry for the gay rights movement when the county revoked sexual orientation from its non-discrimination policy, and Florida's Citrus Queen, Anita Bryant, commenced her nationwide anti-gay crusade, Save Our Children." Seems like a bit of repetition here. Okay. "The implications of her crusade was the vile lie that all homosexuals are pedophiles and all pedophiles are homosexuals. God surely has a wicked sense of humor, for her little son that she dragged around with her on her campaign, of course, ended up coming out as gay himself a few years ago." Connell continues, "The LDS Church later invited Ms. Bryant to come to Utah for the Utah State Fair, and both Spencer Kimball and the General Relief Society president, Barbara B. Smith, held news conferences praising Anita Bryant and her work to save America from the homosexual menace. Meanwhile, back at BYU in 1976, trouble was brewing. On September the 1st, 1976, BYU's Board of Trustees founded the Institute for Studies in Values and Human Behavior, hereafter referred to simply as the Values Institute, with Dr. Alan E. Bergen as its director. Although the public was not informed of the true nature of the ironically named Values Institute, its goals were to produce an anti-gay scientific book written by Bergen and Victor L. Brown, Jr., funded by church tithing monies, which would be printed by an Eastern press and made to appear as though it had no ties to the church. This would then be used as secular evidence to back up the church's stance. Other Values Institute goals were to prepare anti-gay papers and rebuttals, support academic and scientific research vindicating the church's stance on homosexuality, and lastly, to recommend to the First Presidency specific steps the church might take in combating homosexuality and other sexual misconduct. And most horribly, at Brigham Young University in 1976, Dr. Eugene Thorne, head of BYU's psychology department, oversaw PhD Max Ford McBride in his PhD dissertation that involved experiments on gay men using gay and straight pornography with electric shock therapy. They started out with 16 gay male BYU students and staff, but two committed suicide during the experiment, so the study only ended up with 14 subjects. Now, Stephen James Matthew Price, an alias for Stephen Zacharias, a 22-year-old gay convert to the church from Davis, California, near Sacramento, was living in Utah at the time and personally knew the two men who had committed suicide during Thorne and McBride's electric shock therapy on them. And this became the driving force behind his conviction that a support group for gay Mormons needed to be formed ultimately in order to prevent any future suicides. Bob Waldrop, a young convert and missionary recently returned from Australia, moved to California, where he came out in 1979 and then became affiliated with the Metropolitan Community Church, or MCC, an evangelical church with a specific ministry for gay people in San Jose, and decided to train for the ministry. In February of 1977, Bob Waldrop was called to become the worship coordinator for MCC Salt Lake. In the early spring of 1977, Salt Lake MCC sponsored an organization meeting in their gymnasium on 900 West, 400 South. Waldrop and several other gay libertarians and MCC members, all of whom had been LDS, by the way, including Thor Upwall, 1944 to 1995, these various men had come up with the idea to organize a Salt Lake Coalition for Human Rights. Beside MCC and the Libertarians, representatives from the newly found Royal Court, as well as the gay bars and the Socialist Workers' Party became involved, most of whom were former LDS and even BYU students. This group decided to hold a large conference on June the 9th through the 12th called the Salt Lake Human Rights Conference. They invited nationally prominent gay activists, David Copay, who had been an American star football player, and Leonard Matlovich as their keynote speakers. David Copay, although not LDS, had been an NFL quarterback and had come out of the closet after retiring. Leonard Matlovich was a highly decorated Vietnam vet who had been a Mormon convert and, after earning a Purple Heart, came out to the Air Force, which had tried to expel him, and he was successfully fighting their anti-gay policy in court. He was also the first out gay person ever to appear on the cover of Time magazine, and a movie was made about him.
Kenneth Klein, one of the organizers of the Salt Lake Human Rights Convention, had been involved with organizing gays at BYU, and in fact is the one who had published a pamphlet now known as Prologue. Prologue had been written in the spring of 1977, mainly by gay BYU student Cloyd Jenkins, aided by Ricks College faculty member Howard Salisbury. Jenkins wrote this paper in response to an anti-gay lecture he had attended on campus, delivered by Dr. Reed Payne at the time. Jenkins' remarks were simply known as the Payne Papers. Kenneth Klein had gotten Donald Aldridge to do a pencil sketch of the BYU campus for the cover artwork and published the Payne Papers, and then somehow had gotten the pamphlet to be mailed out by the church office building to all general authorities, plus TV and radio stations and many BYU professors, etc., making it look as though the pamphlet was a BYU published and approved by the church. This stunt caused a huge controversy in the church and on the campus of the Y. In any case, Kenneth Klein had somewhat sneakily booked the Mormon-owned Hotel Utah for the conference. However, when the presiding bishop, which ran the hotel, found out the exact nature of the Human Rights Convention, it reneged on the contract, and the convention had to be held at a smaller, much smaller, lesser-known hotel downtown. Stephen Zacharias and his network of gay friends at BYU decided to use the Salt Lake Human Rights Convention as the vehicle to organize what he envisioned would be called Affirmation Gay Mormons United. Now, organizing such a group from a religious tradition wasn't new, and in fact, Connell points out, the name Affirmation is certainly a consequence of the whole touchy-feely positive vibe of the late 60s and 70s. Gay Catholics had organized in 1969 and called themselves Dignity. Lutherans Concerned was founded in 1974, as was the gay Episcopal group Integrity. LGBT Methodists had begun meeting in the early 1970s, but in early 1977, they formally organized as Affirmation Gay United Methodists, or GUM for short. Zacharias and his group from BYU seemed to have taken the name from the Methodists, only instead of GUM, it was GMU. GMU? Affirmation Gay Mormons United. Within Utah circles, GMU also stood for Gay Mormon Underground, especially on the BYU campus. Zacharias later said that they chose the name because they wanted to affirm their unity in opposition to Mormon attempts to divide and conquer. And in fact, Spencer Kimball and Boyd Packer, in their early 70s pamphlets and speeches, often forbade gays to meet together and were told not to speak to each other, emphasizing personal alienation to these tactics. Zacharias said, we're saying, nope, we are not going to stoop to the divide and conquer program. So we decided to band together. So we were going to be an affirming group that supported and welcomed each other, and we were going to stand united. So that's how GUM, or GMU, was named.
I like the name GUM because GUM is sticky and sticks, and we gays are not going to go away. Connell also pointed out, within the Mormon tradition, we have the 1971 founding of the support group for black Mormons named Genesis. As this group became a specific pattern for LGBT Mormons to follow, recognizing a shared sense of misunderstanding, misinformation, and the need to band together for social and hopefully ecclesiastical change. Zacharias had stated that he founded Affirmation realizing that there were basically four aspects of support that gay Mormons needed, which are still quite relevant today. LGBT Mormons need psychological support, social support, spiritual support, and political support. Fear of church retaliation leading to excommunication, expulsion from BYU, and being outed to families and wards kept the members of Affirmation from using their own names in meetings. Many of the early Affirmation members used their middle name as a given name and their mother's or grandmother's names, maiden names, as their surnames. Back to the Salt Lake Human Rights Convention. Friday, June the 10th, was reserved mainly for press conferences and the two keynote speeches by David Coppe and Leonard Matlevich. On Saturday, June the 11th, the attendees broke out into various caucuses, and it was on this day that Affirmation Gay Mormons United was formed by Stephen Zacharias, a.k.a. Matthew Price, and about nine other men and four women believed to be Camille T., Dorothy M., and two women only known as Marsha and Jennifer. Zacharias called these four women the glue of Affirmation that kept it together. Tight security at the hotel prevented LDS infiltration, and in fact, two Mormon security agents posing as gays were caught and turned away from the convention. Attendees were told by word of mouth to wear any color of shirt but white, and these two men showed up in white shirts and were thus caught. Other than organizing the group, the newly formed Affirmation decided to set up weekly family home evenings in which members would meet on Monday nights to fellowship together in Salt Lake and, I believe, also in Provo. Zacharias claims that there were two gay people in BY security at that time who would quietly let Affirmation know what was going down to help them dodge any booby traps set by the church. Affirmation got off to a fairly good start, especially after a November 1977 article on it appeared in the Advocate magazine mentioned earlier, where Steve Zak is quoted, "We have said we've had enough. Gay people are not second-class citizens. We are children of God. We are important people, and we have just as much worth as our heterosexual brothers and sisters in the church." So after that article came out, Paul Mortensen in Los Angeles started corresponding with Steve Zacharias. Zacharias, paranoid about church security, tracking him and other members down, moved to Denver around Christmas 1977 and moved Affirmation's national offices there. On January the 28th, 1978, six gay Mormons met in Paul's West Hollywood apartment and membership there skyrocketed. Zacharias soon burnt out and relinquished his post to Paul Mortensen, after which the national organization moved to Los Angeles.
For the next 30 or so minutes, we'll share slides and personal stories and testimonies. The first, perhaps, is indicative of how the news of Affirmation spread.
Speaking as Russ Lane. Greetings from Dallas. I'm currently the contact person for North Texas. Dallas, by the way, was Affirmation's headquarters city in 1978. It was in 1978, during the summer, that I was serving as a full-time missionary in Sacramento, California. One day I got a call from a gay acquaintance, a pen pal named David Headland from Southern California. Knowing that I was on a mission, he personally announced that he was going to be baptized that coming Saturday. After recovering from the shock, I replied, "But David, you're gay!" "Oh, it's okay," he said. "There's a group for gay Mormons called Affirmation." That was the key I needed 5 years later when I finally faced the reality that I was gay. So 6 years after its founding, I attended my first Affirmation meeting in Salt Lake City. The reception I received was cordial, but rather reserved compared to my enthusiastic entrance at that meeting. Chapter director John Cooper later admitted, "We weren't sure what to think of you. Maybe you were a spy from BYU?" There are many people who've given much to make affirmation what it would take an hour to name them all. But thanks to all of you who've been or are executive or local leaders, officers or volunteers, and all you've done and the differences you've made, may affirmation's next 30 years be even more successful.
Since 1978, Affirmation has held annual conferences where people come together in different cities to learn to strategize on education initiatives, to celebrate ourselves and mourn our losses. National and international leaders in the gay, lesbian, transgender, and bisexual communities have spoken and conducted workshops, as well as straight allies within the LDS community and from the greater community. For example, the highest-ranking out religious leader in the United States, Episcopal Bishop Eugene Robinson, will speak at the Affirmation Conference this October in Washington, D.C. We have also played and danced and been entertained by regional and national performers from around the country and overseas. Here's a teaser of what conferences are like. It's an excerpt from an Australian documentary, Lost Tribe, about Affirmation. In 2003, the annual Affirmation Conference was held in Salt Lake, and we had Australian and Mormon-born comic and writer Sue Ann Post join us with her partner from From her trip to the States, a documentary was filmed and aired on National Australian TV in November of 2005. And a year later, it aired in North America on cable station Logo. And she also came out with that book. As the youthful Affirmation gained numbers and energy and boldness, its leaders in both 1979 and 80 requested audience with the first presidency, but were denied. And since that time, hundreds of folks have sent letters to the first presidency and members of the Quorum of the Twelve. The accompanying slides are, for the most part, chronological and go through some of the through the conferences we've had over the years.
Speaking as Ina Mae Murray, I am a woman whose primary social psychological okay, I don't speak as a woman every day, so this is kind of, sorry. Psychological, emotional, and erotic interest is with another woman. I do not dislike men. I prefer women. I think there's something in my genes, my nature, that makes me this way. I do not think it is from the way my parents raised me. Why me out of my nine siblings? As far as I can discern, my upbringing was essentially the same as the rest of my family and friends. I came to recognize eventually that a great deal of my feelings of oppression came from my upbringing in a patriarchal church. Women are the neglected and exploited minority in the church, with more women members than men. What? Majority. Exploited majority in the church. With more women members than men, the emphasis is still on the men since they hold the priesthood. The church's programs for working with homosexuals are directed towards gay men. Lesbians are even more invisible than gays, hardly rating a line in the manuals bishops use for counseling homosexuals. I do not know how I came to be this way. If God has some scheme for me, I do not understand it. I only know that I am happy with my life, and I am not sorry for the decisions I have made. In 1979, I heard about two groups, Mormons for ERA and Affirmation, Gay and Lesbian Mormons. I became active in both, and especially in Affirmation, where I have held many leadership positions, including 2 years as international coordinator. We fill a need for many members of the church. Why? Because gay and lesbian members approach the church troubled and anxious and in search of compassion and understanding. Instead, we find a refusal to listen to our feelings at all levels, from apostles and church social services personnel and BYU professors to stake presidents and bishops. We find tunnel vision, people refusing to look beyond sinful behavior to see the tremendous loss of uncounted souls who would be active, contributing members if allowed to be ourselves and not forced to hide. The church does not recognize scientific assessments of homosexuality, nor the personal experiences of its own members. Talks have been given in conferences and church-wide firesides and pamphlets written which blame a poor family life. These talks must drive daggers into the hearts of parents who know that this is not true but have a lovely son or daughter who was an exemplary member until his or her unconventional love surfaced. Little compassion or understanding for those parents or that person comes from untrained bishops, poorly trained counselors at church social services, or officials at church schools. So in recent years, the only place to turn has been Affirmation. We are a self-help support and social group. We do not try or intend to take the place of the church. In the past 8 years, we have been a lifeline for thousands seeking the understanding and caring from others like themselves. I pray for the day when affirmation is not needed, when we have an understanding of the plan of salvation that could include a recognition of our love, and when we have better informed and better trained church officials and members to help us sort through the pieces of the puzzles of our lives.
Ina sent that to us. It was actually printed about 15 years ago. Yeah. So it's a little bit out of date, but actually not much.
I'm the next.
Hold on. Michael, let's see. Michael, the affirmation coordinator in the UK, says the following.
Okay. We started Affirmation in 1981 in central London after I had realized a need for an LGBT minority support social group. I had been a member of the church for over 5 years, having fortunately been visiting professor of theater arts at the University of Utah in the 1970s. Although still an active member, I started a chapter at my apartment in Knightsbridge, London. I did this with a recently excommunicated High Council member, a recently returned missionary who was sent home for having had a relationship with his companion in California, came to visit us. Unfortunately, after one meeting, he got jittery and went and told the bishop about us. The bishop called us in. We thought we were for it. Imagine our surprise when, after having spoken at length about affirmation and playing a cassette tape of a KSL TV recording of Affirmation USA, the bishop and the stake president canceled the rest of the evening's schedule, listened intently, after which the bishop gave us his unofficial blessing to counsel with anyone who might be concerned.
And Connell O'Donovan shares his coming out.
I am alive today because 20 years ago I started attending Affirmation. I showed up at what was then the Wasatch chapter, a confused, embittered, frightened, and deeply suicidal 25-year-old gay Mormon, struggling in my soul to reconcile my sexuality and my spirituality, and I thank God that wonderful people reached out to me with the strong hand of fellowship, friendship, and unconditional love. I was suicidal from a life of self-hatred, alienation, social condemnation, and quite frankly, ecclesiastical abuse. I was at the Tabernacle as a young man during the priesthood conference session when Boyd Packer gave his infamous For Young Men Only speech, and remember him praising violence against me and even worse, acknowledging that I felt I deserved such retribution for my sinful thoughts and desires. As a youth, I nearly memorized Spencer Kimball's chapter, The Crime Against Nature and the Miracle of Forgiveness, which used vitriolic and disparaging language like ugly, detestable, abominable, diabolical, demonically inspired, vile, vicious, disgusting, hateful, to describe me and my sexuality. The members of Affirmation were also there to support me through my bishop's court when I met with my bishopric, which included former Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson, who was then running for governor. Fortunately, that court only decided to put me on probation, which was the perfect decision for me at the time because, with hindsight, I know that had they done nothing to me, I would have languished for many more years in Mormonism. Or if they had decided that excommunication was in order and forwarded my case to a high council court, I would have killed myself out of shame and humiliation. But being put on probation angered me just enough to help me to leave and go find my own spiritual path, which I call the Good Rainbow Road, taken from my Indian brothers who walk what they call the Good Red Road.
James Kent.
All right. Now we'll hear a tribute from James Kent in Hawaii.
Thanks. In May of 1988, I desperately clung to my heterosexual identity, totally unable to deal with my homosexual feelings. The LDS Church had to be true, and I couldn't be gay. In the ironies of life, it took a straight Mormon friend, Chris Bailey, to discover Affirmation. Together we went to an Affirmation meeting in San Francisco's Castro District at the Metropolitan Community Church on Eureka Street. Imagine my feelings as I sat in a room of 31 gay and lesbian Mormons with the realization that I was not alone. The feeling was exhilarating and terrifying at the same time. Ina Mae Murray and her life partner Stella Armijo Lopez went out of their way to introduce themselves, giving me some reading literature and made me feel welcome. The following week I went by myself. Then every Sunday I would drive up from Fremont to attend the San Francisco Singles Ward and Affirmation's evening meetings. In the fall of 1990, with the encouragement of Ron Kershaw, one of the founders of the San Francisco Affirmation, I was voted in as chapter director. It was a challenge to come up with discussions or activity each Sunday, but I was in good company with lots and lots of help. With the help of my dear affirmation friend John, each of us came out to our parents on Thursday, October the 11th, 1990, National Coming Out Day. In 1993, I made a career decision to move to Philadelphia. I started a newsletter called Philly News, which was mailed out to about 30 people about twice a month. It has since evolved into Ohana News, which now electronically goes out to about 280 people about every 2 to 3 days, the vast majority of whom were or are members of Affirmation. Now I have Affirmation friends throughout the United States, Mexico, Canada, Australia, China, and Sweden. Affirmation is part of my family of choice. I'm grateful for our spiritual, cultural, and social bond of camaraderie. More slides.
How I Escaped Spiritual Darkness by our current executive director, Olin Thomas. In 1986, I was a young second lieutenant in the U.S. Army stationed in Savannah, Georgia. I was also LDS and trying desperately to be celibate at the ripe old age of 25. I had long been aware of my homosexuality, and years of prayer and counseling had failed to change me. I had accepted that I could not change my orientation, but was hopeful that I could avoid acting on my innermost feelings. I was miserable and felt there was little to look forward to in life. One Saturday morning, as I lay in bed wondering why I should even bother to get up, I was suddenly overwhelmed with a sense of spiritual warmth and energy. I clearly understood that I was receiving a message, which was that I had been created just as I knew myself to be, and this was not a mistake. I further understood that I was not supposed to be miserable, but joyful. I also received the message that I was to strive to be a good person, but I did not have to deny my sexuality to do so. Immediately, I felt as if a weight was lifted from my shoulders. It was clear to me that I needed to get on with my life, and instinctively, I realized that if I continued activity in my ward, I would remain fearful, hesitant, and depressed. How could I tell them I was gay? Would they believe me if I told them I had a personal revelation that I was? It didn't seem possible, so my road to happiness had to lead elsewhere, to at least for the time being. Even when all the wisdom of hindsight, I believed that this was a genuine revelation. Events were already in motion that would result in meeting Mark within 3 weeks of that date. I quickly fell in love with him and he with me. I put religion out of my mind for the next 7 years, or I thought I had. However, it seemed odd that I would be angry at the church for what I considered my rejection. Even though I left under my own power, yet I also would defend the church against any criticism my friends or acquaintances might make of it. I felt I was in a spiritual no man's land. It was darkness and it was lonely. This eternal conflict began to unravel after Mark became ill and passed away in 1993. Okay, I'll try to speak up. Swallow the mic. I had by this time learned of affirmation and began attending the local chapter in my home of Washington, D.C. I found it a great social outlet, but had not addressed my deeper feelings about Mormonism. After Mark's death, I faced a new darkness, that of depression and despair. Losing the first and only person I had ever loved was more than I could bear. I needed spiritual guidance and comfort. I returned to the church. Everyone I met there in my new ward was kind and seemed accepting, even when I told them my story. But I felt like a fish out of water. That spring, I participated in the March on Washington for Gay Civil Rights, along with a large contingent of Affirmation members from around the country. With these people, I did not feel out of place. I felt comfortable immediately at home. I began to consider going to my first Affirmation conference and did so later that year. It was my experience at the 1993 conference in San Diego that made me a true convert to Affirmation. The stories of the people that touched me deeply. Hearing their struggles so much like my own made me realize I was not alone. The humor, the camaraderie, the empathy, the sheer joy of life that I saw all around me was so real and so genuine, it was almost an epiphany. What I saw around me was the manifestation of what I had sensed in my personal revelation 7 years earlier. This was the type of joy I was supposed to have in my life. Since that time, I have only missed one Affirmation conference. At each conference, I have learned more about living life to the fullness. My criteria for measuring a conference was a good one, was was a good one and is simple. Simply, was I moved to tears at any point during the conference? The answer has always been yes, and usually more than once. I have met the most incredible people over the years. The anger I felt towards the church evaporated, and so too did the deep-seated fear I had that I was going to be damned for all eternity for being gay, no matter how right it felt to me. These feelings would not have disappeared without the very positive outlet of look of affirmation events and affirmation friends. They both helped me to understand and accept that not only was I gay, but I was also spiritual, and I did not have to choose the one or the other. The great strength of affirmation is in the myriad personal connections one makes with other members. This is the same characteristic that impressed me about the church. Salt Lake might be impressive, but what made me come back were the members of my ward. We call affirmation conferences family reunions with good reason. We have become family for each other, and those bonds can endure. My work now is to work at keeping a competent framework in place so that the members, new and old, can gather. Then the magic of the human connection will take over. I have come to realize that the way out of spiritual darkness requires very human guides and traveling companions. I am grateful to have found many of them through affirmation.
Speaking as another woman. Sarah Jordan. Every story has a beginning, and this one started auspiciously enough on a toilet seat. Did you have to make me read this one? In a wild Matisse-appointed bathroom of a shotgun-style duplex in New Orleans. Although I was the primary resident at this address, in fact, I shared it with my then-girlfriend of several years. She was not my first great love, but she was my first female lover. We met in the sociology department at the university, encouraged by a mutual professor. I was a recently returned missionary, enjoying single life in the Crescent City, but missing my companions and colleagues in the West where I had been before. I sought company from other local Mormon young adults and Todd Institute, both to my peers of university age and to members of the local Spanish-speaking congregation. I had plans for a future with a nice LDS boy when Karen and I met, but somehow, over months of interaction with her, I found myself wanting, enamored, and confused. Increasingly, I became depressed, having no language, no guide, and no person to explain what was happening to me. Between ourselves alone, we forged a path together, and apart from the Mormon world I had known. Finally, in 1994, we got the courage to attend a local gay pride celebration. Surrounded by people like us, plus as we called them, the world began to make a little more sense. I hungrily collected every bit of literature that was offered. Many weeks passed before I made my way to the newsletter of the Catholic group Dignity. On the bottom half of an inside page, I read, dumbfoundedly, an announcement for the upcoming national meeting of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons. Although it was quite late, I got up and called the number on the page. A woman answered. In those few minutes, my life changed. I had contact with someone who knew my worlds, someone who had walked the road I was on. She, too, had been to BYU and fallen in love with a woman. And she told me about the upcoming conference. I don't remember how we did it. Two graduate students at the beginning of the semester with little money and only a few weeks to prepare to go, but we did. Karen and I flew to Las Vegas, and there we met more people who shared my love of some primary songs, who missed singing hymns, who weren't sure how to interpret their patriarchal blessing given the new facts on the ground, or how to explain food storage to the in-laws. By the end of the year, Karen and I had relocated to Salt Lake City. This was not our intended destination, and it took me a while to adjust to life in a place I had known only as an active Mormon, and I was a little put off by the heavy male dominance of the local affirmation chapter. But eventually, both the city and chapter became home. With others, we expanded women's space in the organization, worked to establish a more visible presence in the GLBTI and straight communities, met with LDS leaders, and continued to provide a safe environment for those who were struggling. I have loved my interaction with affirmation over the years. Time and again, it has provided a place for me to grow, to give, to be enriched, to leave, to expand, to come back to, and like a family, to go out again. In 2002, I left the U.S. answering a call to move more deeply into the world. When I returned, nearly a year later, affirmation provided yet another opportunity to explore my identities, this time through writing. Through the National Writing Contest, members and friends of Affirmation have a forum to articulate their life's journeys and ideas about what it is to be from an LDS background and dancing in the GLBTI world. Winning the contest that year gave me the confidence to continue on the writer's path, using narrative to tell the stories of the many and varied manifestations of life across the globe. I am deeply appreciative of the spirit of Affirmation and of the people who continue to care for those it serves. Affirmation is an organization based on the timeless principle of friendship. This is its strength. It asks only that people come as they are, flawed, confused, brilliant, perfect, and it takes them to a place beyond identity. It's been 13 years since I first encountered Affirmation. It has given me a bedrock on which to stand as I have redefined who I am in the world. It gave me a community at a time when I had none, and exposure to people whose lives' paths were both similar and vastly different from my own. It gave me a safe space to explore the relationship between spirituality and sexuality, to ultimately understand that these are dualistic concepts and not opposites on a continuum, but the absolute essence of life itself. The last 5 years have taken me to worlds beyond Affirmation, to countries, cultures, and communities where gender, religion, and politics are played out in other ways. I continue to explore these themes and give thanks that I can always come home to Affirmation.
It's my turn to develop my feminine voice here. The following is from Nancy Batchelor, which she calls Crossing My Bridge and Finding Affirmation on the Other Side. I had left the church for a few years after attending Ricks College. My girlfriend at the time was tracted out by the missionaries and had the missionary discussions. We mutually decided to change our ways, and she was baptized by my father. She subsequently married and moved out of the ward. I was happy at church for several years and felt resolute in my testimony of the gospel, but through a series of events and a move to a new stake, I began living my double life again. Fast forward to the mid-80s, and my partner Susan and I had been together for a few years. We had an active social life, partying with friends on weekends, and on most Sundays I pulled it together to go to sacrament meeting in the singles ward. I felt reasonably successful at keeping my two lives separate, but of course the guilt demons periodically came. One day while reading the local gay newspaper, Susan spotted a small personal ad for a gay Mormon organization named Affirmation with a California post office box address. She encouraged me to make contact. I couldn't believe such an organization existed, and I was very leery of responding, fearful that somehow my name would get back to the church. Susan continued to gently prod me, and I finally sent a letter with a phony name asking for information. I received some printed materials and promptly filed them away. Fast forward a few years to the mid-1990s. I was by then going to a family ward that I thoroughly enjoyed. One Saturday night we were at a party when I was introduced to a temple-married LDS woman who had just moved out from her husband and young children to come to Portland to start a new life. The short version of the story is that she became aware of Affirmation, found out there was a small local chapter, and coerced me into going to a potluck event. I was beginning my journey across the bridge. I didn't know quite what to expect. I was thirsty to find other gay Mormons, but I was also very curious to discover if the people in this group had been well grounded in the church and had ever had a solid testimony. As luck would have it, at that first or second get-together I went to, Gary and Millie Watts were there with their daughter, who was graduating from a local college that weekend. That was a huge validation for me. As I learned more of other people's stories, I felt my guard come down, my heart open up. This was probably the beginning of the transition from the voices in my head telling me that I was not worthy of Heavenly Father's love to being just shown just the opposite. Our first Affirmation conference was in 1998 when it was held in Portland. I was nervous because it was being held here within my ward boundaries. I'd grown up in this area and my aging parents still lived in the stake. My parents never showed me anything but love, but I did not want to cause them any pain or awkwardness in their church associations by being found out. Another few steps onto the bridge. That conference began to change me in ways I could not foresee. I saw the love and camaraderie, the fun, the irreverence, but I also saw the pain, the challenges, and in many cases, I saw the peace I desired. Most importantly, I heard many stories of otherwise faithful Latter-day Saints who had had testimonies, who had served missions, and who had married in the temples and had families. I went home excited, strengthened, less afraid, less alone. I began receiving the Family Fellowship and Affinity newsletters, more insight and strength from the sharing of personal stories. Susan and I have managed almost all the conferences since that time. There hasn't been one where I was not touched and taught in some way, or where I was not challenged in my thinking. The conferences, the friendships, the terrific websites of both Affirmation and Family Fellowship, loaded with so many resources, James Kent's Ohana News, and various email lists have all given me hope, comfort, assurance, and strength. I want to thank all of those who have come and gone in Affirmation and have added so much to the tapestry of my life. Your lives have comforted me, strengthened me, and given me the courage to live my life openly and in peace.
A few more slides. Why Affirmation? Despite its ups and downs, Affirmation has served the gay, lesbian, Mormon community for 30 years. What draws people to the organization? Here's how some Affirmation participants from around the country answered the question.
Chella, when I came out, I was too homophobic to go to the Stonewall Center or clubs. The people at Affirmation became my surrogate family during my coming out process. They provided a safe environment for my personal growth and a friendly sounding board for my doubts and fears. They opened my eyes to the diversity and beauty of my newfound culture.
Rick, when I first accepted my homosexuality, a local support group such as Affirmation was a tremendous help in dealing with all of the issues I faced. Now that I've dealt with many of those issues, I don't often need a support group, but I feel an obligation to give support to those who are just starting to deal with these issues, just as others gave me support when I came out.
Darren, I enjoy the camaraderie of Affirmation's national conferences. I enjoy socializing with people who have a similar background to mine. And the background I'm talking about is not the Mormon religious background, but the Mormon cultural background. I understand these people, and they understand me.
Esther, after being excommunicated, my partner and I did not attend any group affiliated with the church, but I needed my church and my people. We came across Affirmation where we were met with great compassion and love. I was back in my family with the greatest support I could ever have hoped for. I belong.
Ed, when I first came out, I went inactive to avoid dealing with the issues of church and homosexuality. Over time, I missed many aspects of the church. One of these was the fellowship. Affirmation provides me with opportunities to meet and talk with others of similar religious backgrounds and helps me to come further to terms with who I am.
Jeff, I knew I was gay before I married my wife, but I thought God wanted me to change. So I got married, but it didn't change my feelings. Finally, this conflict got the better of me, and I slowly began to lose my grip on reality. Affirmation allowed me a place to be my real self and talk to others like me.
Heather, I felt very alone, as if I were the only lesbian Mormon. I wanted to meet people who understood me. I wanted to acknowledge myself as a lesbian, but not forget my Mormon background and heritage. I wanted a safe place to be myself and not have people put a guilt trip on me.
Bart, when I was first coming out, I found the local gay paper and saw an advertisement for Affirmation. I was stunned. Others, like me, the very knowledge that I wasn't alone was like a cool drink on a hot day. I'm trying to rope together a group now in Denver. I just remember that someone out there is wondering if they're the only one.
Joan, my husband Bill and I participate in Affirmation because we find love, understanding, and a great source of comfort. Affirmation was a healing place for us. It afforded us a place to air our hurts, concerns, and trials. We received advice, hugs, and a great many listening ears. It is like our family. We rejoice with them, we cry with them, and we walk the path with them as they heal and grow.
Joan and Bill's son died from AIDS about 10 years ago, and they've been involved since that time. As these personal voices attest, Affirmation draws people for a variety of reasons and thus constitutes a diverse community, despite the commonality of background and experiences which brings the group together. As such, Affirmation serves as a microcosm of the united diversity to which the gay community is largely aspires. Hopefully, this diversity will continue to make Affirmation a strong, welcoming community for GLBTI Mormons in search of information and support.
Jason Giles, who, by the way, does not have an 80s rock band named after him, I asked, wrote this. In the spring of 1997, I first learned about Affirmation from a man who was a Portland chapter leader at the time. I jokingly asked him whether he'd been called to the position by a gay general authority type person. He wasn't. I was then invited to join him the following week at a potluck dinner for gay and lesbian Mormons, and I asked if there would be Jell-O salad. I went, and there was. But more important than the Jell-O, which I found strangely comforting, was the fact that I met many wonderful people that evening. At times we talked about our commonality of being LDS and being gay, and as I heard some of the group members share their stories, I was elated. I was still in the coming out phase, not yet out to my family back in Utah, and to be in a room with 15-plus other individuals who fully understood my struggle was powerful and exciting. And they were all such great people, easy to talk to and fun. Okay, so a couple of them were kind of weird, but you get that in any group. I began to attend affirmation activities regularly, and I began to build friendships with many great people who greatly helped me in my journey and my reconciliation of becoming a proud gay Mormon. After a few years, I became Portland chapter leader, and I have seen the group help person after person with their journeys. Just like I received great support from my affirmation friends before and after I came out to my family, I have tried to support others as they have gone through coming out difficulties with family, the excommunication process, divorce and custody battles, deaths or illness, and the other challenges life throws our way. I have also been thrilled to share in the good times of affirmation friends, including marriages and commitment ceremonies of devoted couples, birthdays, and so forth, and whether we are bowling, picnicking, raising money through the annual AIDS walk, marching in gay pride, or having yet another potluck dinner, we always laugh and talk and enjoy one another's company. We have developed our own annual traditions, like going to the Portland's best haunted house attraction, Scream at the Beach, and our Thanksgiving Christmas holiday feast. In 2005, our numbers in Portland have grown to the point that we've had approximately 50 people attending two of our last four activities. I have personally made some of my closest friends ever through my association with Affirmation's Portland chapter, and I am profoundly grateful how it has enriched my life. I want to thank everyone associated with the chapter, past and present, who have played a part in this. By no means does Portland have a monopoly on amazing GLBTI LDS folk, so my hope is that every major city in the country and the world can develop a living, growing, fun, and supportive chapter like the one we have in Portland.
We've had so many wonderful stories shared, and we want to have a little time for a discussion, so I'm going to cut one or two as we go. So if you'll go through slides to the year 2000, slowly. You're not speaking on mic.
Okay, so I'm going on with Dave Melson from Washington, D.C. Two of the things that have made Affirmation D.C. an active, happy, and friendly chapter have been that everyone has a great respect for everyone else, and that we try to never take ourselves too seriously. Our activities range from informal social get-togethers and entertainment to very serious speakers and political LGBT civil rights activities. After all, this is Washington, with an amazing number of events that either center around or feature food. Sounds very Mormon. Nonetheless, at the end of the day, we know that the reasons we are together is simply to be around other people who share the unique or strange perspective of being both gay and Mormon, be it spiritually or culturally or socially, or being closely linked to someone who is. My first affirmation meeting was on a Super Bowl Sunday and in the middle of a snowstorm. Four people showed up, including the host, the chapter leader, and me, but I felt as though I had come home. My favorite event each year is the Affirmation DC Thanksgiving dinner. When I walk in the front door of a beautiful home to the smells of turkey and of the holidays and to the embraces of 40 or 50 great men and women, some of whom have traveled a few hundred miles from the far edges of the chapter, I know that these folks are my family. After dinner, we will sit together and share with each other the things from the past year for which we are thankful. The list is always long and the day is always special. Our meetings and activities vary greatly in format and venue. A lot of people attend most events, some come now and then, but beneath the surface, there is almost always a bond. Over time, we have helped each other to come out of the closet, to survive divorce, excommunication, or the hurt of family members who don't understand, to grieve the death of loved ones, and to celebrate partnerships, marriages, and milestones. Our Thanksgiving hosts for the past 2 years, Robert and Lanny Graves, have become our mission president and surrogate parents. And yes, we have a Relief Society president and a stake president and others whom have earned titles of affection.
Affirmation around the world. Though Affirmation has had international chapters in several English-speaking countries with contacts scattered throughout Europe since the early 1980s, in the last 6 to 7 years, Affirmation has really grown internationally, in large part to the Internet, and especially in South and Central America. The following is an interview with Hugo Salinas, which Hugo Salinas had with Bruce Leguias Contreras of Chile. How did you get the idea to start Affirmation Chile?
I had been in a long-term relationship with my partner, but I considered myself dirty, cast out from God's presence. Then in 1997, when I got internet access, the first thing I did was to Google Affirmation, which I had heard about from a friend. I was stunned to discover Affirmation had a web presence, and I helped translate homosexuality and scriptures from an LDS perspective. At about that time, my partner died, and my life experienced some dramatic changes, but I never forgot Affirmation. Eventually, I contacted two other Chileans, Juan and René, from Santiago, and we decided to start Affirmation.
How did you promote the idea?
At first, it wasn't easy, but I found on the web a cheap, effective way to promote Affirmation. Sometimes I would go into a chat room with a nickname such as Gay Mormon, and people began to approach me. On a daily basis, I was contacting up to 3 people with whom I could talk about my idea of launching Affirmation.
How did the gay community in Chile react when you began to show up at gay at Pride and other gay events?
To this day, every time Affirmation is mentioned, there is both an ovation and expressions of unbelief. MOVILH, Chile's movement of gay integration liberation, has been a great support, even allowing us to meet at their headquarters for free. MUMS, Chile's Unified Movement of Sexual Minorities, and
ignored us,
but now they too have offered us space for our meetings. We also have a good rapport with Chile's CEGAL, CEGAL, a gay interfaith group, and have participated in services with them.
What's Chile's bill for civil unions, and how is Affirmation participating?
The bill for civil unions would allow 2 people to be recognized by the state regardless of their gender or sexual orientation and obtain most of the rights married couples enjoy, including health insurance, shared ownership of an estate, and retirement benefits. Affirmation has established a strategic alliance with MOVIHL in support of this bill, as well as another bill against discrimination. We are also taking steps towards becoming a legal entity, which is similar to a non-profit organization status. Even though we know that the LDS Church opposes marriage equality, we believe that we can re-examine our doctrine and our scriptures and rid them of old errors. We can use faith and reason as we lead the way to the promised land, a place where instead of exclusion and discrimination, we are all worthy children of heavenly parents who love us unconditionally. Learning this has been for me the beginning of a happier, fuller life and has given me a sense of purpose.
Affirmation Chile boasts today 2 chapters and contacts in 6 cities. Why do you think you have been more successful than other countries in Latin America?
We have in Chile over 550,000 Mormons, a larger pool than any other country in Latin America. I am amazed at how many people contact us and subscribe to our virtual community, and yet we are still working with very limited resources. From Arica to Punta Arenas, Chile is 2,400 miles long, and we would like to be able to visit our contacts in distant regions. I wish we could help every person who is trying to reconcile their spirituality and their sexual orientation, especially when lives are at stake. But I believe the Lord of the Harvest will send more and better laborers in his own time.
Do you think the situation of GLBT people in the U.S. is different from the situation in Chile?
Yes, because cultural circumstances and individual development are different. In Latin America and in Chile, machismo dictates that males must be machos and females must be feminine. This affects our social and cultural behaviors and how we act in church and at the workplace. As for the Catholic Church, their actions and their discourse are always ultra-conservative. The same clergy that condemns people for loving someone of their own gender justifies a dictator who ordered the murder of thousands.
Is there anything you would like to add?
Yes, we must remember that Affirmation's work saves lives. We are all our sisters and brothers' keeper. We are all responsible for what happens when people are discriminated against, excluded, or condemned by the church. Affirmation's work entails not only accepting ourselves, but also saving others. When Affirmation Chile has participated in public events, the response by active straight Mormons has been overwhelmingly positive. On occasions, we have talked with as many as 400 Latter-day Saints, and only 5 or 6 disapproved of us. Somehow, most church members seem willing to accept that gay and lesbians too are God's children. We seem to be living a new era, and fresh winds are blowing over the church.
Continue through slides, and we're going to cut a couple more stories out. Okay, here's another segment from the Lost Tribe documentary, the Saturday Night Banquet entertainment part of the comedy routine of Sue Ann, plus a little bit before that of getting her there.